And if we hear any animal noises, it's just my sister's cat. And
okay.
I'll shoo her away.
Unless it's a nocturnal animal.
Unless it's a nocturnal. God.
Or is it Belu Pear's cat?
Yes. That useless thing.
So, welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. The Vice President-elect is not invited and will not be here. we have convened to talk about three movies that would all be maybe surprising choices for Thanksgiving entertainment, and yet here they all are in the last week or two. But before I say what they are, I'll introduce your usual host, who is slightly ailing today, Nathaniel.
Hello. A little bit of a sore throat. I'll be okay.
And our Buffalo correspondent in the field, Joe Reed.
Hello.
Katie, I think we have it on good authority, is enjoying a rare moment of sleep away from her newborn in a different house or something. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, they were at a road wedding. So
that sounds complicated.
Yeah. So I don't know where we would want to start, but we have Isabelle Huppert being attacked over and over again. We have Amy Adams reading a book that I felt I was being attacked over and over again. And we have Billy Lynn's long halftime walk, which I don't know, you all may have seen in its insane frames per second format, which is not what made it to Chicago.
Oh, interesting. That's very interesting, because I thought, to me, that was the one sort of, not good part of the movie, but interesting. Like, I thought that would be the reason to see it, because I thought the movie itself was pretty bad, but not even, like, fascinatingly terrible, just kind of jumbly and didn't really, know how to tell its story and had weird tangents and was poorly paced. And I thought that at least the visuals, I was seeing something new and interesting and not necessarily good, but like that's at least something I could chew on.
Yeah, I gather only New York and LA have prints and maybe projecting capabilities that allow for that format to be supported.
Well, so from what they told us at our screening, which was in a small theater, for those who aren't, New York City, which is presumably a lot of you listening, there's a multiplex with a bunch of different sizes of screens called Lincoln Square. And on their smallest screen on the main floor, that's where they showed Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. And Ang Lee came out and spoke, and he said that specific theater was one of only two in the nation that could show it the way it was made. And I was like, then why make it that way?
Why make it?
Yeah.
Because I did not like the experience of watching it at all. So I had to take myself sort of out of what I was seeing which is a weird thing to say about a movie. I had to take myself out of what I was seeing in order to try to see what kind of movie it might have been if it hadn't had that useless like frame rate situation.
For me, it made me feel like I got the way that high frame rate does appeal to filmmakers in terms of how it can make certain things, not everything. Sometimes it just makes it look odd and strange and like you're watching TV that hasn't been properly like formatted yet, that you haven't like turned off the motion smoothing thing.
Sounds
but
great.
Sometimes it does get that like hyper real, like it did for a few of the scenes during the halftime show where it looked like there were people in front of you and like you're watching a movie and whatever, so then all of a sudden your brain starts going into like Uncanny Valley stuff. But it made me feel like at some point somebody's going to be able to make a good movie out of this technology. And they're going to do it because it's incredibly uncinematic technology is the other thing. It just makes something look real and not like a movie. And somebody's going to probably be able to harness that to use its very uncinematic qualities to make something cinematic, if you follow me. This is not that movie, but it made me feel like if somebody wants to like follow this technology down that road, it wouldn't surprise me. But the movie itself, to me, is just really bad.
Yeah, I mean, I just the technology itself made it look so cheap to me, and I understand it's a very expensive movie, but even the halftime show, which is like the big climax slash set piece of the movie, goes on for a long time, and it's better in a way. I thought it was better than the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But even that, because, you know, like, Destiny's Child's supposed to be performing, so you're supposed to be watching Beyonce, sort of.
Yeah, but it's...
And if you're going to... If you're presenting something that is supposed to appear hyper-real, but you obviously don't have Beyonce there, and you're telling us that we're standing right next to Beyonce and we can see that it's not Beyonce?
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Well, it's sort of like how you don't say Yahweh. I don't think we're supposed to look right at Beyonce.
It's funny because from what I understand from people who read the book, that in the book, it's explicitly the Dallas Cowboys and their stadium and their owner mentioned in the book. And of course, all of those things, because they didn't get, I'm assuming they would have had to pay for the trademark rights to all of those things, that they didn't use that in the movie. So already, if you've got this fictionalized football team with this fictionalized stadium and this fictionalized owner, then to have stand-ins for Destiny's Child and call them Destiny's Child seems to me the strangest bit of continuity there. Just like, if just, you know, call them whatever, like make up a fake name. It's, you've already gone past the point where, you know, we think this is something that's happening in our world, so.
Right. Yeah. Empire does it every week, makes up famous musicians.
Yeah, totally.
Maybe Beyonce was like, I've heard this is some fucked up movie with a weird frame rate. I'm not trying to be in that. Make a good movie. I'll be in the ice storm. Okay. I don't even like the ice storm that much. I will say that having seen it, Joe, when you were saying that it felt like that was the one reason to really see the movie, was at least to experience this technology for better and worse. Like, to not see it in that technology definitely does feel like you're watching a movie that is missing some kind of chief asset. Like, it just doesn't make... I mean, in some ways, my reactions really converged with yours, the two of you, because, like, the halftime show was the one moment when I felt like I sort of perked up. But that said, I feel nervous saying this because I don't want it to sound like I remotely think that the veterans' experience has been exhausted as a topic for movies at all. But this movie doesn't really find new ways, from my perspective, to dramatize that. And even some of the gestures that come out in the halftime show, like the fact that anytime there's a loud noise or, you know, pyrotechnics go off, like the soldiers are terrified and think that they're back in war, and then Billy is actually flashing back to war at those moments. Like, right. I feel like we've seen a lot of that before.
Well, the whole movie to me felt like a skimming of the surface of the sort of greatest hits of veterans issues of 2016, where it was, you know, you had the sort of oil guy coming over and annoying them, and you had the way that, like, the women react to them, and you have the way that the owner wants to exploit them, and you have the PR guy, and you have, you know, they mentioned body armor, and they mentioned how, you know, the football players have better, you know, protective equipment than the soldiers do, and it's just like PTSD and everything, and it's just like a skimming of the surface of all of these things, but not in any way. I thought the one scene where he's in the sort of he's in the hole where he has to kill the guy, that sort of very close hand-to-hand, that to me was probably the most effective scene of the movie. That's the one where I felt it the most viscerally and was very kind of tense. But I think everything else, because so many of the other issues that these soldiers sort of talk about in this movie are very, they're kind of...
Hello?
Talking and not really seeing it. The fact that this lead kid playing Billy Lynn is also not that good really tends to deep six the movie.
Mm. Oh, I on that I would disagree. Like, I thought he was the best person in the movie.
Oh, wow, okay.
Because there was... You know, it's always a little weird to use things you hear in, like, presentations of movies to judge movies, but one of the things that Ang Lee was saying in his little speech before the movie was that the high frame rate made acting styles more apparent.
I can see that.
So he had to be careful with the actors to, like, don't act, per se.
Yeah.
Because it feels too much like you're watching someone act, you know.
Well, but the high frame rate, that didn't necessarily mean that he had to film so many things in such close-ups. Like, that was also a very strange choice, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, that's... Martin's,
yeah.
But that's what I felt from the, you know... Maybe because I've never seen him before, so I think it was smart to cast an unknown. I wasn't thinking of his performance at all, and so I was with him. I just wished the movie was serving him, you know?
Mm.
Because, like, people I normally like, I've come to respect Kristen Stewart, and I thought she was kind of bad. I thought Vin Diesel was kind of bad. So, and I thought even Steve Martin wasn't that good, and I love him as an actor, so it's like,
yeah.
I just thought everybody, I could see, maybe I was incepted because he said that in the speech beforehand, but I could see all this acting constantly, and it just really bugged me. And so with Joe Alwyn, I didn't see that.
Hmm. Yeah, I just felt like I was watching a whole movie of secondary characters in a Clint Eastwood movie, where you don't even have the two people in the middle of the movie who are giving really solid performances and everybody else is getting shortchanged. I just felt like everybody was being shortchanged.
Yeah, that makes sense, too. The other thing I didn't like about it at all, I didn't think worked at all, and I don't know how it differs in... I assume you saw it, like, 2D at a slower frame rate, Nick?
I live in the Midwest. Yes, I did.
Okay. So, I don't know how the editing came off for you then, but for me, there's also a thing Ang Lee warned us about. One of the reasons that the takes are longer is because editing is more jarring in high frame rate. So, it's too apparent where the edits are, which is why, you know, there's not as much editing, per se. But even that, like the dissolves, I found it's so awkward. Everything about it felt awkward to me.
Yeah, it's uncinematic is the word I keep sort of coming back to because it so limits itself to the kinds of things it can do and do well.
There's this one sequence where Billy is imagining himself back in his home or something, and it's sort of like heavy with dissolves, and then he's like. It's like a camera floating through his house or something. Do you guys remember this scene? I think it ends up being the same scene as where he's like imagining making love to that girl or whatever. That whole sequence was just so uncomfortable, and I don't mean on a sexual level, even though it was like a sexual imagination scene. It just was shot so poorly. It felt like a super cheap, like, I don't know, like Ghost Hunters on TV or something.
Ghost Hunters?
You know, one of those shows where they have the cameras on their shoulders and they're like, oh, what did we just see? It was just so gross looking, the whole movie.
Amazing.
Yeah, I did not like it.
Yeah, and her, I didn't totally know how to read the last beat with her and him, but everything that had sort of built up to it, I don't know. It does feel to me like I think I'm the least consistent Ang Lee fan of the three of us, and it does feel like occasionally he just turns out a movie that you're like, why? You know, like, not only that, it just seems to not have any of the special qualities of others of his movies, but that I didn't feel a huge investment of the movie in itself. Like, it just seemed, for all this talk, it just reminds me of academia, how when everybody presents their 20-minute paper and sometimes it sounds like they wrote it on the plane and they keep talking about, well, in the longer version, this is a lot clearer. It's like, well, then maybe don't read this version. Like, this whole, like, well, two theaters in the country, you would see how amazing this is. Like, Jesus. Like, how many impediments do you want to enforce on your own story?
Yeah.
Not all of which sound plausibly like they're about that.
Whatever.
The one thing I will say about Ang Lee, and I feel like it does come through even in his bad movies, is he seems like a filmmaker who's incredibly empathetic to whatever he's making a movie about at all times. And he sort of, even in this, you sort of feel him sort of, you know, you feel the way he feels, I think, about these characters. And it's, at the very least, not cynical. And I guess that's like a, you know, a low bar to sort of cross. But it's one of the things that I feel like even when I'm not totally on board with an Ang Lee movie, I can at least be like, you know, I can appreciate the experience for him more so than I can appreciate the experience for me. And that's like, you know, small favors, but whatever.
I think I see what you mean, but I don't know that I quite agree, I guess.
Okay.
I don't, sometimes I do feel like he's, in his best movies, I do agree with that. But sometimes even when he's not doing these kind of major technical experiments or something, I do feel like he's just kind of poking around material he hasn't yet decided to make a movie about. It's a little bit like Steven Soderbergh, where sometimes I feel like I get what the idea was that made you think this might be your next project, but sometimes I feel like you're well underway having decided this isn't really your next project. And that, and that comes through in a way that, like, the actors just feel... I mean, I think about this all the time anyway, but I was thinking about that Anne Hathaway, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler joke at the Golden Globes about how they'd never seen anybody that abandoned since you hosted the Oscars with James Franco. I sort of felt that way about a lot of the people in this movie. Like, was anybody directing you guys? And like poor Garrett Hedlund, who always seems about like 6 inches away from stardom, but just can't quite, it never quite comes together. I don't know.
I really like him too.
Garrett Hedlund. I like him. Then I just thought about him answering the door and On the Road, and I felt a little bit better. Thanks, Garrett. Well, since we're already on a tear, should we just deal with Nocturnal Animals pretty fast?
Sure.
Yeah.
Because Jesus Christ, like, give me Billy's halftime walk immediately.
I will say it's funny because watching the movie in Toronto, it felt like, Nathaniel, and I don't know whether you felt like this too, but like, I felt very much in the minority of people who weren't digging the movie, because that first screening, people were like, really into it, and really into the aesthetics of it. And,
well, it had just come from winning the jury prize at Venice, too.
Yeah, and like, you know, turn over a rock and you found another gay critic who were sort of like falling all over about like the, you know, the beautiful aesthetic of this movie and how like, you know, the humor in it was so like dark and fucked up and blah, blah, blah. And I was just sort of like, eh. Now that it's gone, you know, wide or whatever its approximation of wide is now, this when it's open now. But it's a little bit more in line with the reaction that I was kind of expecting it to get.
Yeah, I mean, I was negative on a tirade after it. I thought it was just so gross and, like, repulsive.
Garbage. It's so garbage. From the very first, like, I've complained about this to enough people already, but, like, good Lord, the cynicism and grossness and, like, meanness for no good reason of those opening credits. And so, like,
absolutely.
That's sort of like every bad thing you think about the fashion industry is sort of like wrapped up in that, where it's just sort of like, you know, oh, how fascinating these, like, you know, normal people and how perversely disgusting these people are. And it's just like, it isolated me from the movie right away. And the whole rest of the movie kept just sort of like pushing me away even further. It was a very unpleasant viewing experience, I will say.
Yeah, I mean, I went on a tirade after the movie with, you know, some people down the escalator, because people kept saying, you know, because I had heard, you know, that people kept comparing it to Almodovar.
Oh my God.
Right. And so I went on this tirade, and sorry, Nigel, I didn't realize Nigel at The Guardian had used the word Almodovar. And so that had been, like, quoted or something. So people, you know, it became something people were saying about the movie. And I was just so furious. I was like, I didn't know who had written it at the time. I'm like, have they ever seen an Almodovar movie? It's like, it's like the exact opposite of Almodovar, except that it's colorful. And it's not even colorful in the same ways. Because it has no humanity. And Almodovar, like, obviously loves even the weirdest, most perverse, gross characters.
Even especially those.
Yeah. And this is just this is just a hateful movie. Like, it wants everyone to suffer.
Yeah, he doesn't even like his beautiful characters.
Right.
Like, yeah. And I liked A Single Man. Like, that's the thing. Is, like, I get the sort of knock on A Single Man is that it's, you know, all aesthetics and hollow at the center. And I didn't quite agree with that assessment of A Single Man. I thought there was at least something in there with that sort of mournful Colin Firth character that came across in the way that it filmed the Matthew Good character and Nicholas Holt. There was something that it said about sort of desire and repression and memory and things like that that wasn't perfect, and it wasn't, you know, the best movie of that year, but I thought it definitely had something to say. And this movie, if it has anything to say, it's just sort of, you know, ugliness and blunt, and the couple little, like, colorful little highlights in there where, like, Jenna Malone comes in looking like, you know, an alien secretary and things like that. Like, I guess it sort of brightened things up, but not enough to distract from the grossness at the center.
Yeah.
I even hated that. Like, that just seemed like a way low-balled movies joke at the expense of, like, the fashion industry. That, like, this one was at least purporting to have some, or the art world, I guess I should say, and that this was at least having some pretense of, like, knowing that world well enough to set a movie in it, but I don't know. I mean, it wasn't, like, near the top of the list of things that irritated me, but, and I did feel like you that, you know, I hate that feeling where something happens so early in a film that you already just are mad at it, and it's only 3 minutes in, because... Yeah. It just sets you up to feel animosity for what's coming up, and you don't want to go into a movie like that. But
and the fact that
every bad feeling that credit sequence generated was just more than borne out by, like, almost every single choice in what followed.
And that it has such a thin tie to the rest of the movie, even on, like, a most basic thematic level. The only reason that it's there is to be like, Amy Adams is an artist with bad taste. And it's like, oh my God. Like, as soon as I realized that was the reason for it, I was furious. I was absolutely furious. Am I the only one who thinks Jake Gyllenhaal was pretty bad?
No, a lot of people think he's terrible in it. I've been reading that.
Really, I think he's poorly... If not poorly cast, then it's just like, it's just a bad performance. Like, it's one of the two. I don't know, but...
Which I don't feel about her exactly, but I don't feel like she's like set up to succeed either.
Right.
And, like, whereas it does kind of exacerbate, I think, some of his least good instincts as an actor. Like, her good ones just aren't really called up for duty, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, don't know why you would have cast her. Although I did like her in some of the scenes, like where she's having to talk through her bad reaction to his novel. It really was the scenes where she didn't have any makeup on. I occasionally felt like she was doing interesting work. Once Tom Ford dressed her and covered her in eyeliner, which just gets me back to the fact that, like, I mean, I saw it with a friend who also felt like it was really beautiful but had nothing underneath it. And I just don't even see that. Like, I thought the characters looked bad. I thought the movie looked kind of bad. I saw that it was trying to go for a movie that would be kind of ravishing at some level. I didn't feel that way at all. Its strategies for being chic seemed kind of mundane. Like, I just don't see the good taste in his movies, even visually.
It's such a blunt instrument, the way he sort of, like, now watch as I contrast this, like, sleek, chic sort of fashion world where everybody is put together with, you know, dusty, rapey, like, American Southwest. It's so, like, funky and ham-handed and dumb. It's just
and
dumb.
Speaking of rapey, the ad campaign is not helping the movie either. Like, the release of the soundtrack,
Yes.
The staged dead bodies are the cover of the soundtrack. I'm like, that's charming.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. God, that made me so mad when I saw that. Like,
I just found the movie repulsive. Like, I hate it more and more as time goes by.
Yeah,
and I'm very. I'm flabbergasted at the prize from Venice.
I don't even accept that it reinforces bad things I already thought about Sam Mendes and what he prioritizes in movies.
Was he the jury president?
He was the jury president. And I can't even assemble in my mind, like, we're all used to not agreeing with outcomes, but it's just hard to imagine what the case for this movie involves. I know I have some article by somebody open on my phone that I haven't read yet. That was, do you know which one this is that is saying it's like Showgirls? It's like a brilliant satire of exactly the things you think it's just about. Mm. And I haven't read the case yet, so I can't judge it, but the movie seems so convinced that it might be doing something like that that I felt like it for sure was not doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like you disqualify yourself from going for this Showgirls thing when you are sort of. When you're a movie about a woman reading a book about, you know, it's like that sort of, novel in a novel kind of thing. And it's like, okay, well, you're still trying to maintain this, you know, sheen of, you know, fashionability and kind of classiness where it's just so false. Like, Showgirls had no illusions about itself, and that's why Showgirls got to be Showgirls.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, you know how filmmakers have struggled for a long time with computers and the internet and cell phones and how to make that cinematic that people are always like looking at a screen? It turns out that they've been getting better at that, but reading books is still boring to watch.
Yeah.
Like Amy, all those close-ups of Amy Adams, like turning pages or shutting you know, the book or whatever, I was like, oh my God, it's just so dull.
My friend who writes for Jezebel wrote about that in his review about, like, there are so many scenes of Amy Adams just closing a book in sort of aghast and kind of and shook by whatever she's just read. And so I responded to him, I was just like, in many ways that makes this the sort of spiritual successor to The Neverending Story, because that was what all that movie was too. It was that kid, like, shutting the book and being like, oh my gosh. That kind of Amy, that's kind of all that Amy's given to do in this movie.
Which also, it's completely clear, right, that that's a horrible novel. Like, there's no way she's reading a good book.
Right.
But the film, didn't it kind of think that maybe he had found his voice? I mean, it's not his first novel even, right? Like, it's like darker than my usual stuff, whatever. It's like, this is definitely shitty. Like, there's no question this is shitty. What a stupid book.
Yeah, I did feel like it was sort of, like, punishing her for not recognizing his talent.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Even though there was no evidence of his talent.
Yeah.
And that might have been the only interesting thing for me about the movie, was that sort of push and pull of, like, living pragmatically versus pursuing dreams and how that can curdle, you know, marriages. Like, I thought that was vaguely interesting, but the movie wasn't really interested in that.
Well, no, because then it finds itself so easily distracted by, like, Laura Linney and giant pearls and the Texas accent, which, again, sort of like the Jenna Malone thing, I sort of appreciated the respite into something
it's
like entertainingly bonkers for like a second, but then before I was plunged back into the movie that I wasn't liking.
Well, if anybody in comments can make the case for what a defense of this movie would even sound like, it sounds like the three of us are equally mystified about what that would even be, like, to a completely unusual level. So maybe we'll just move on. Don't go see Nocturnal Animals. Like, I'm so rarely in the position of, like, don't even see it. Don't even make up your own mind. But I'm like, don't support this bullshit. Jesus, it's terrible. Like,
there are so many other good movies out there, too.
Right, there's.
You have better choices everywhere.
Yeah. Or even if you want to watch something that is going to put you through sexual assault over and over again and be polarizing, there's another choice.
That's better.
And I think we don't, we're not all necessarily on the same page about L.
No, I think
Joe, you're mixed, right?
I'm mixed on it. I'm more mixed on it. I see why it's a good movie. I get hung up on the kind of Verhoeven-ness of him being the filmmaker to give us this film. Uh-huh. And I know that's sort of like inextricably tied. Like, it's not, you know, you wouldn't be getting the film you're getting without him. But the subject matter to me felt so provocative that it makes me sound very basic, but like, whatever. Like, I would have liked to have seen what a female filmmaker would have done with this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like because it's, you know, this man at the helm, and he's so into kind of taking things to the edge and pushing buttons, and I'm like, that's all well and good, but like, you know, it irks me that he's doing all of that button pushing with this story about a woman getting raped, where, you know, it's all provocation and no risk for him. Mm-hmm. And kind of bothered. But that clearly was not...
Did that feel like that was gumming up the movie at the scene level for you, or did it feel like that was an umbrella to the movie that just pollutes everything, even if you're into it?
Yeah, I thought on a scene-by-scene level, like, it's a movie that works, and it's a movie that, you know, kept me fascinated and sort of, you know, it never wasn't taking me out of things on a, like, a ground level, but just on an overall, like, there was a cap to how much I was ever going to be able to like it, I think, because of that, because of
okay.
It.
Yeah, I I attended a little Isabelle Huppert event the other day, and I was really surprised at how...
Can't
like,
we have a movie about your life, can I just say? I would watch that.
I was really... The reason I bring it up, I wasn't... It's not bragging. The reason I bring it up is that I was surprised at how... Like, it was a very, very older crowd, and I know that people joke about that with the Academy all the time, but some of those events skew more normal demographics, you know? And this one was decidedly older. Like, everyone was older. And I was surprised how, like, obsessed they were with the movie. They would not stop asking questions. They went way over time on the Q&A. They just kept grilling Isabelle about everything about what she thought of the character. So they were obviously really into it, which surprised me. So I think there is a lot of, like, hooks other than how provocative it is. For one, because it's entertaining, which is a smart choice. You know, it's very funny.
Yeah.
And of course, like, if you're going to make a movie like that, you have to have an actress who can, you know...
Who feels like the director.
Yes. It felt like a... Yeah, I would say directed by Paul Verhoeven and Isabelle Huppert.
I mean, I observed the same reaction in the Chicago Film Festival audience, which Joe has experienced as well, and it was that audience for sure.
Yeah.
But I also, it was clear in the room that, like, maybe half the people seeing it in a sold-out theater knew exactly what they had bought a ticket for, or at least understood the contract they were making,
right.
With likely to come. And then half the people were very nice, older, wealthy people supporting the arts.
Right.
And were kind of shocked, but any kind of prejudice or condescension I might have brought to, like, whether they were going to be able to hang in there for this was also totally wrong. Like, they were gripped. Nobody left. In a way that was cool to experience with such a big group. Because I'm sure when this comes out, you would be seeing it with, like, 12 other sophisticates or something, you know.
Right.
And it was a really different movie to experience in such mixed company of all kinds.
Yeah, I mean, that's I was pleasantly surprised, like, but I did think it was funny that people kept trying to, like, get Isabelle Huppert to commit to, like, something about the character, you know, like, so she's a total masochist, right? And she would be, like, she'd brush off any reductive things. She's like, well, we're all masochists, you know? So, So
like how the Eskimos allegedly have like 47 words for snow. She's like, don't even start with masochism. I know that better than you do. Okay. Like,
yeah, and I was really glad that she spoke out on how the movie ended up being made at all, because you know there's been these conflicting reports and everybody's like, wait, what's going on here? Because Verhoeven keeps telling this story about all these American actresses that turned it down. Isabel keeps talking about how it was her project to begin with, and you know, somebody suggested Verhoeven to her.
Mm.
So she addressed that. So finally the stories cohere, because she was just like, oh, well, I had read the book and I wanted to make the movie, and you know, someone suggested Verhoeven, and then suddenly he was looking for American actors. They tried to betray me, she said in her beautiful French accent. Uh-huh. But then it came back to her. So it sounded like a Christian Bale American Psycho thing where, oh, maybe we can get Leonardo DiCaprio, and then they gave up and went back to Christian Bale.
And did they include Paul Verhoeven, or kind of over his head?
No, they included Paul Verhoeven.
Oh, man. Well, that would have been a nice set.
She clearly loves him, though. She went on and on, which, of course, sounds just like her, you know? Like, yeah. she says Turkish Delight is one of her favorite movies.
It's what they watch at Thanksgiving in Uber.
And she also mentioned, sorry to talk about Isabel's Q&A so much, but she also mentioned that...
Oh, yeah, I hate that.
Well, I was really proud of this because she couldn't remember the name of the movie and I shouted it out for her. So she looked over and she's like, yes! Cranes Are Flying.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What did that have to do with it?
No, she just said it was the movie that convinced her she wanted to be an actor.
Wow!
Yeah. So she's one of her all-time favorites. So anyway.
So this might get back to, Joe, what you were saying about just feeling not even only a man's fingerprint on the movie, which is already something to think about, but this particular guy.
Yeah.
How did you all bear up under the multiple times? Like, I was explaining to the women in my film group, to whom I was also saying, I don't feel like I can pick this because there's just no way I can assume 30 women want to go see this. I can't even assume any particular person in my life wants to go see this except like you guys. Like, I loved it and I don't know who to recommend it to. But I was shorthanding that, like, the rape in this movie is almost the plane crash in Sully. You're just going to keep getting put through it from slightly different shift. And on the one hand, I feel like that is what the movie is about, and it's one of the reasons that the movie is distinctive, that it is traumatic repetition, and it is awful for her, but she's also clearly interested in it and re-narrativizing it and even imagining it. But that's a lot to ask from an audience, especially when you're helping them out but also making it weirder by making them laugh in between. So how did just the sheer experience of being there pan out for you guys?
It did feel after a while as if sort of all roads were funneling through that same kind of topic, where, like, it's not only the multiple scenes of assault and her kind of, as you said, like, reimagining it and recontextualizing it, but also that she's carrying on this affair with her friend's husband and all the sort of aggressively sexual things going on at her workplace with, you know, that video game rape scene that you see so many times during the movie. And it felt like that we were presented with this character who was kind of suffused with sexual assault, that was sort of like she was, you know, like instead of like a being made of light, she was like a being made of like sexual transgression. And and that was kind of her superpower. We were sort of being asked to sort of except that, like, even, like, the other people in her life, when they find out that she's been sort of up to some of these things, that they're all just like, oh, Michelle, that's just Michelle. That's sort of, that's her thing that she does. And I'm like, okay. Like, it was, as I'm thinking, like, I don't know.
I thought that was what was fascinating about it, though, was the idea of, like, the ideas of guilt and shame and or the lack thereof, was, I think, really interesting because of how, and the idea of whether or not she was culpable in her father's violence, let's say.
Oh, right. God, I even
forgot. From her backstory. So, like, I liked that all of those things were intertwined to the point where it was just so difficult to untangle any of it.
Yeah.
Because I think that that's actually how people's lives are. Like, you can't just point to, unlike, you know, biopics, you can't just point to one thing and say that defines the person.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's this mix of, like, all of these things about you, and also the fact that she was so judgmental about other people's sexuality was really fascinating to me, because she was obviously, like, in some ways shame-free about her own, or thought she was. Like, the fact that she's so repulsed by her mother's sex life.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was really just fascinating movie. And I, at least for the humor side of it, I thought that was the only way to make it work, so I was really glad that they went there. Because it's such, it is like a traumatic movie in some ways. So, like, you have to have something to, some...
Port in the storm?
Yeah, or like a, some lifeline to hang on to through it, you know?
Yeah.
And, but the brilliant thing about that was the humor was never taking you out of it. It was just, you know, relieving some of the pain of it. The humor was also about that. As you could hear, we had a lot of feelings about Elle, so this podcast will be split in two. The second part will be coming in a day or two, and we'll also give you some streaming recommendations. Thanks for listening.